Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today, for lack of a better title, we're going to just say the subject is produce and more.
There we go.
Yeah. And our first up is a real firecracker, Kitty Keller. And we had so much fun talking to her, and her products are so wonderful. She sees what she wants and she goes after it. And, as I said, she's quite a pioneer in what she's doing. The one thing I love about the specialty food industry is that it has so many fabulous people involved with it. And we're going to be talking to one, Kitty Keller, today. Her company is KL Keller. And I don't say color right because my Pittsburgh accent, Kitty. But anyhow, you have such an interesting background. I originally contacted you about one particular product, but give us the overview of how you ended up with this company.
Well, there's kind of a simple, with me, there's always two stories, the simple one and the complicated one. The simple one was, I wanted some walnut oil that wasn't rancid.
Yeah, but that's
the more complicated one was I was in Europe and was supposed to bring back some walnut oil for some friends. And I thought, gosh, if these fancy people want it, maybe other people would too. And so I started kind of an import firm, mostly on a hope and a prayer. My first products, were walnut oil, and then I moved to the vinegar banyuls, and then in 1997, Fleur de Sel, and we kind of stair-stepped our way up, moving into Spain eventually.
We were in the Fleur de Sel before anybody even thought about it, right?
Oh, gosh, it was terrible. We were cleaning, all right, I shouldn't say this on the radio, but we were cleaning the salt in our kitchen because it does have to be lightly processed because it's an unprocessed salt. So you take the little stones out. And we were doing just fine. I thought, who's going to buy $35 a pound salt? So I figured, oh, 2-3 cases a week, it's fine, it's jewelry. Well, then the New York Times ran a 2-page article on how cool Fleur de Sel was. I mean, we were cleaning salt at 2:30 in the morning. We were cleaning salt on Super Bowl day. And so I finally had to get something. We arranged something more professional and moved it into the mainstream in a food service facility. But, oh, gosh. Yeah, we were in it early. And we still, to this day, our producer is an individual rather than a cooperative. I was down in the Algarve in Portugal, I guess, in 2004. And I was talking to them, they had Fleur de Sel, and they go, oh, we've been selling the cooperative in Guerande, Fleur de Sel, because they were running low. Now, my guy has no such capability, so our Fleur de Sel, as with all our products, are always vetted.
It's interesting that you should mention that subject, because when we were in Provence or Languedoc, I forget which it was, we went to Aigues-Mortes, which is the home of Fleur de Sel in France. But I was always fascinated by the rather unique containers with the big cork in the top, but also by the fact that this guy signed every single one of them. except that I realized that, in fact, they really weren't individually signed, even though they would have you pretend that that was true.
Now, I read someplace, Kitty, that if we're going to describe your product line, basically you said that you buy and import things you would like to have in your own pantry.
Yes, it's all come from stuff I wanted in my kitchen. And this sounds really silly. We have a line of mustard produced to our specific recipe. I mean, most people, when they buy mustard, they buy a big 55-gallon drum. They throw the crud in it they want. They go in with an immersion blender, and then they run it through the line. But no, that was too easy for me. We found a small producer in the Pacific Northwest who would produce recipes to order. That is, we decided what the mustard tasted like. Then we always send up spice kits. So these things are totally, totally our recipes. We just don't happen to make them because we don't have the equipment. But what started the whole thing was, I wanted mustard made with the vinegar banyuls. Mm-hmm. That started the whole thing. I mean, now we have five six mustards. But I wanted it for my sausages at home. So that's actually a true story. I mean, certain olive oils I'll take because I go, oh my gosh, I'm going to put this on, such and such. I mean, right now I've got some, Soriana coming in from Spain. That's the new harvest. I'm going, oh, thank goodness asparagus are here. I'm making aioli.
Were you a cook to start with?
I've never been a professional cook. I've worked in the back end of a couple of kitchens, but mostly it's just something I like. My family was Southern from Kentucky, and so we always had a home garden, fruit trees, and my mom and my grandmother both raised me with the idea of the respect for people working. I remember a time when my brother and I were probably 9 and 10, and we were in Kentucky going out to the country to see Howard and Minerva. And they were farmers. I mean, Howard was still doing the fields with a mule. And we were so excited. My mom goes, oh, gosh, we're going to have biscuits. And we were so excited. My brother, oh, we're going to have biscuits. Oh, gosh. And we get all the way out to the country in this way out-of-town place in Kentucky. And Minerva is so excited that her sophisticated cousins are coming that she'd been to town and bought Parker Rolls. And there was it's been a long time since I was 9, but it was bitterly disappointing. But there's always been that focus on food within my family and within my life.
Now, interesting question for you, because I'm a great believer in the fact that English mustard is the superior mustard to have with sausages. which I incidentally adore. I have a huge weakness for the honest British sausage, but I usually can't get English mustard now. And then Reckitt and Coleman came along and somehow tried to repackage and remarket Coleman's mustard on a much larger scale than they ever had before. But that's a powder. Now you're importing something different than that.
We're importing from the Pacific Northwest in the United States. We send them foreign ingredients, and they make mustard.
Right.
But that being said, some of the disappointment with American mustards is the percentage of mustard seed. Ours runs between 25% and 28% mustard seed.
Okay.
Something like I'm not supposed to mention brands here, so I won't. A large industrial Dijon that has a French name is about 11% or 12%.
Oh, wow.
So the whole idea of that spicy mustard you're thinking of from England was, A, the kind of mustard seed, because a couple of them are spicier than the others, and don't ask me that today, I'll never remember. But B, the amount, that's 100% mustard seed when you're making that. Oh, I was going to say, I'll send you a jar of mustard and you can see if you like it. I hope it suits your taste.
Well, you know, we were talking to somebody, and I found out that yellow mustard in general has turmeric in it, just so it's yellow.
Well, a lot of companies use turmeric for a lot of. Turmeric is a kind of an interesting thing. It does add a little bit of flavor. I mean, if you use it exclusively, it's a lot of flavor.
I love it, the fresh stuff.
Well, as do I. But you see it in mustard and sometimes in products with saffron in them because it holds the color better.
Uh-huh.
And because one of the things in the modern food business is the retailers want 6 months life on things, a minimum.
Yeah.
And so, you know, these products have to hold up for a seemingly long time.
Right.
In order to have enough volume to for anybody to earn a living. You know, the kind of the paradox of large distribution is kind of good and bad.
Well, now, I originally contacted you because I was reading about this product that I didn't know anything about, Yandilla mustard seed oil. Tell me about that.
Well, it's a wonderful product that we kind of backed into years ago. Dina DeLuca, it was Dina DeLuca in St. Helena, had said, oh, do you have any mustard seed oil? And I called somebody I thought had somebody goes, oh, I don't want to do that anymore. You call them. It was some guys in Australia. And so I started importing, and it was, you know, it had a label that was so ugly. Only a mother could love it, but it kind of sold because it was a specialty item.
Uh-huh.
And then over the years, things changed, and in April 2011, the FDA put what's called an import alert on mustard seed oil because of the presence of something called uric acid. Now, that is not uric acid. We know where that comes from.
Yeah, we do.
This is uric acid. And they made us start testing every time we had an entry. So this mustard seed oil would come in, and we would call the FDA. They would send an inspector down to look at it, and then we'd call a private lab and would send somebody in, and it looked like a murder. They'd go in, they'd open the boxes, they'd take pictures of the labels, they'd inventory everything, they'd seal it with their tape, send us a result in 15 days, we'd send the FDA, and then in 30 days, they'd go, oh, yeah, it's fine to eat, it has no uric acid in it. It turns out that I had backed into the only food-grade mustard seed oil in the world. Now, it's a little bit of a story, but I'll try and abbreviate it. This woman by the name of Kay Weatherall was from Australia, and she wanted to see the world. So at 21, she went to England, and then she was working for something in government, and they sent her off to Nepal, where she met a fellow by the name of Weatherall and married him and stayed in Nepal, and they lived there until they were ready to retire, and then they moved back to, of all things, Yandela, Australia.
Now, where is that in Australia? Where?
It's called Yandela, Australia. It's, oh gosh, don't ask me that. I can't get the, I'm bad at Australian geography.
Oh, yeah. We still
and it's a little place out in the country where they were growing, I think, primarily wheat. And Kay wanted this mustard seed oil to cook with, and there was none there because the FDA deems anything with uric acid in it as not fit for human consumption, for topical use only. And that is how all the other mustard seed oil in the United States that you see on the market, even on Amazon, is not fit for human consumption, except for the Yandela. Mm-hmm. So Kay starts thinking, and Mr. Weatherall starts thinking, and they go to the equivalent of the USDA and say, geez, we want to breed some low uric acid mustard seed oil. So it took them 7 years. Now, they weren't taking cat hair genes and putting them in a mustard seed oil. They were just going uncle, son, father, using Mendel. And in 7 years,
really?
They bred out the uric acid.
That's amazing.
It is. It was quite a project. And they had a protected seed. So the seed, it's not a patent, and I don't recall what they call it. I'm sorry, just don't know. I know a lot about the food business, but not much about the seed business.
Well, is it a wonderful product, or why would they go to all this trouble?
Well, because it's food grade, and it's fantastic as far as its culinary applications. Now we come to the fun part. We, the other day, took nice sweet shrimp that had never been frozen, tossed them in mustard seed oil, little Meyer lemon, grated Meyer lemon rind on, put a little fleur de sel, put them on the grill and just cook them off really quick, put them on top of a Napa cabbage coleslaw that had been dressed with, once again, the mustard seed oil and a little bit of a dry muscatel vinegar and some fleur de sel, and made a coleslaw out of it. And it was a fabulous luncheon item. It was so easy. When you taste the mustard seed, it tastes like mustard, but it also tastes like wasabi. Because interestingly, the wasabi taste in mustard, horseradish, and wasabi is actually the defense of the plant. So Mr. Cow doesn't eat it all the time. They don't like it. But we happen to like it, and we've cultivated a flavor for it. The mustard seed oil is wonderful. It makes a beautiful velvety mayonnaise. So if you want deli sandwiches with little wasabi.
Oh, that's a cute idea.
Yeah. Oh, it's delicious, and it would be good for potted shrimp again. We also, I was doing a demo on it one day, and this very nice Indian lady said, this is great. I'm taking 3 bottles, which was a lot. And I said, my gosh, what are you going to do with it? And she goes, we fry trout in it. Because it's got a high flash point. It's got some nutritional claims in the omega-3s and 6s, but I kind of think of myself as in the food business, so I don't want to go there. But it's on the whole, a really fabulous oil. You can saute with it, you know, on the meat. One of the guys at work sauteed lamb in it and was really happy with the results.
Well, I have a nice piece of albacore tuna that I got at the store today, And I guess what the recipe is going to be.
Yay. Well, you better, that ex guy better get here. That's what I've got to say.
He arrived.
Oh, good. Oh, thank goodness.
He arrived 2 minutes ago.
Now, I have a question, Kitty. I mean,
sure.
Do you, I know, because we talked a little bit about our friend, Beatrice Ugi, from,
Gustiamo.
I mean, she travels around and meets up with all these people, discovers these products. Is that what you do? You go to a specific area?
Yeah. I do. I do a couple of things. I mean, I've been invited to go to Barcelona for the Alimentaria in April, and that's going to mess with your timing on this do of the show. I'm sorry. But I've been invited to Spain to go to a food show. And there, what I do is go into the small regional booth. I'm always looking for the stuff that is real, that's made by people I can talk to.
Yeah.
So last fall, for instance, I was going to the Anuga, but I went by way of the Basque country in France because we have an espalette producer there.
Oh, yeah.
And I wanted to spend time with him. I've been off to see our Paludier. I'm very good friends with the guy who does our nougat. He sent his daughter here for a summer.
Oh, really?
You know, so I get to know these people personally. My people were farmers, and we understand people who work for a living. And we respect it. And so we have very close relationships with them.
We haven't really, we've enticed all of our listeners, but we haven't really explained to them where to find what you've got and how to get it.
Pretty much all of the fine food stores throughout America have our products. Now, that doesn't mean like Trader Joe's, but it does mean Dean and DeLuca. Calusian's on the mustard seed
right. Oil
in New York City. He's been very good about supporting us. In Philadelphia, I'm going to have to tell you where later because I have no idea. The mustards can be found in the fresh markets throughout the Eastern Seaboard.
Well, now what's
if you ever look, and Zingerman's, of course.
Oh, of course. I went to school in Ann Arbor. I'm a big fan of Zingerman's.
Yay.
Now, hold on a second. We've missed one word out. What's the brand name people should be looking for?
Well, the brand on the mustards is K.L. Keller Foodways.
Okay, thank you. Okay.
The brand name on the mustard seed oil is Yandilla.
Okay.
The brand name on the fleur de sel is Gilles Hervey. But it's easy to go to our website. We have a very comprehensive website.
That's what I want. That's what I want. What's your website?
Yeah, our website is www.klkeller.com.
Okay, that's simple enough.
Yeah, and then there's a link where you can go to one of our retailers if you want to buy products online. So we've tried to make everything simple for everybody. And the fun part about our website is whatever product page you push on, in principle, should have a story about the producer, why we like it, and then 10 things to do with it. And quite a few of those have recipes. And we don't do recipes like, put it on pasta, pizza, and roasted vegetables. I mean, we'll have kind of full-blown ideas.
So what are you lusting after now, currently?
Oh, I like Moroccan. I went to Morocco, and it stole my heart. And
I love Moroccan, too. Do you know Morad in San Francisco?
I've eaten at Aziza's several times. I'm dying to get to Morad.
Well, you know, we interviewed this woman from, she's the director of culinary at Williams-Sonoma, and she actually got to go on a trip with Murad to Morocco.
Wow.
And that sits in my mind, and I'm so envious, I don't know what to do.
Well, that would be quite a trip. I mean, I went on a self-guided trip, so I ate some very bad food, and some of the tourist food wasn't that good, but, boy, some of the other stuff that you bought in the markets was delicious.
Right.
So I'm yearning for Moroccan right now. We've got some preserved lemons underway. God knows when they'll hit. And the California-made harissa, because in some respects that's not particularly a terroir product. You know, because I'm always thinking about what the terroir, what is really from the land or not. And so we're looking at that. And as far as the future, gosh, I'm going to Spain. Let's see what I see there that looks enchanting.
Oh, there's lots of stuff there. Oh, wow.
Well, we have a lot of stuff. Did you look at our vinegar selection?
Oh yeah, that's you know. Do you do Tourangelle?
We don't do any products that have been refined.
Okay.
And one of the problems with nut oils are you cannot chemically detect the presence of refined oil. But the price point, I do Le Blanc, which is unrefined and totally cold-pressed and unadulterated. And interestingly, with Le Blanc, I had asked him to do a Marcona oil for us, which subsequently discontinued. But here's what I found out, which wasn't really where I was going. I bought the Marconas from one of our friends in Spain. That is a guy who does 10% of all the Marconas in Spain. So I knew exactly what the price was.
Mm-hmm.
I sent them off to Le Blanc. He gave me the yield. Here's, you know, because I was buying everything he was making. And I said, would you give us the price? And he gave us the price for him pressing and doing it. And I added it together. Actually, I take that back. And so I knew all the costs of everything involved, including the cost of the nuts. And then I did another order with him where he bought the nuts, but I knew the price because this friend, and I knew all the conditions, and then he charged me for them. And a cold-pressed oil is very expensive.
Yes.
And so if it's not particularly expensive, it may represent a taste profile you want in your kitchen, but it's not going to be 100% cold-pressed oil. It's just an impossibility of terms. It's interesting. Nuts have become the new health food.
Yeah.
And by the way, Ann, do you know who the largest consumer of walnuts in the world is?
The U.S.
Nope.
No, they're the largest producer of almonds, I know.
Yes, but the largest consumer, whenever you put a population of 1 billion, that is China, on eating nuts, it makes prices go up.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't buy a nut from China to save myself.
No. The Chinese are buying them from us.
I know, but I'm just saying, I told Peter we weren't allowed to buy pine nuts from China anymore. I wouldn't trust them.
Well, they're just not that good also. But, you know, and then there's a problem, and this is just, I'm gambling now. The Canadians had some sort of bug that was in lumber they shipped to Europe.
Oh.
And that bug got into both the palm trees and the pine trees,
mm-hmm.
and has been killing them throughout the Mediterranean basin, whereby the pine nut trees are something like half, and there's a problem with the palm trees also.
Kitty, so I could talk to you for years and years and years. I will have to resume the conversation another time. Just call me and we'll talk.
That sounds fine. It would be an honor.
Oh, Kitty, thank you so much for talking to us today. And you sound like you're having a lot of fun.
It's a magnificent business. And I get up every day kind of thinking I'm saving America one meal at a time. On one hand, we bread McDonald's. On the other hand, we've got a bunch of people like us running around talking about good food.
Yes. Well, again, here's to the next time we talk. And thank you.
I'll be counting the minutes. Thank you, and thank you, Peter.
As you said, sweetheart, we could have talked to Kitty all day.
She knows so much about so much.
Yeah. The funny part about it is it all started out because she wanted to get some walnut oil that wasn't rancid.
Exactly.
and this mustard seed oil.
You love it,
it's,
I know.
It's absolutely amazing. I put it on just about everything. I haven't tried it on cornflakes yet, but I might try that next. But the odor, the smell.
Yes,
great. The smell is so extraordinarily intense and interesting that even if you didn't cook with it, it'd be worth having in your larder. So be sure to check out the website and look for some of the other more interesting things the Kitty's brought to market, and I'm sure you'll enjoy experimenting with them. And we'll be back with another fascinating guest right after the break, so don't go away.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Next up, we have another dynamite guest, Susan Ebert. She hunts, she fishes, she dresses, she cooks, she grows. Doesn't she do?
She doesn't import it. She either catches it or finds it.
Yeah.
quite a remarkable lady. And I'm sure you'll enjoy it.
She loves every minute of it. I get exhausted just finding out what all she's doing.
I'm sure you'll enjoy hearing everything she has to say.
After reading the Field to Table Cookbook, I'm going to ask its author, Susan Ebert, one major question. Where in the world do you get the energy to do all of this?
Well, that's a good question, but one does get a lot of energy having been a single mom for 20 years. But the other thing to consider is this is my recreation. I don't go to the gym. I don't play golf or tennis. These are the sort of things that I do to get outside and enjoy the outdoors.
Well, let's talk in specifics about what you're referring to as these are the things you like to do. We're talking here hunting, fishing, foraging, dressing everything, cooking, writing books, caring for two kids. I mean, this is gardening. It's absolutely amazing to me.
Well, my kids are grown now, so that's one less responsibility.
Yeah, but they were little when you started all this, right?
They were little when I, actually grew their fruits and vegetables and made their baby foods 30 years ago. So they never had jarred baby food. I was very intent on doing that right from the get-go and live and blessed to live in a climate where I can keep my organic gardening going year-round. So I've got above ground raised beds because we live in the Sandy River bottom of the San Jacinto watershed.
So you're in Texas. Let's make that clear.
Yeah.
Which is why you have the climate to deal with this.
Yeah.
Although you deal with other issues like drought.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, and Texas, as many people know, is either in a state of drought or a state of flood. There's never really anything in between.
Well, so, you've organized this book seasonally, which I think is a big help. You have, like, what you can fish for according to the season, what kind of things you hunt for. But it's so much information. I don't know how you manage to gather it all. All the stuff that I never knew about. I mean, you sort of casually interweave it into this book. Such as, I always thought snipes were a joke.
Well, actually many people do. And my mother can recall when her younger brothers sent her out on a snipe hunt at night in central Kentucky and left her holding a gunny sack all night long. And poor little Ruby Jewel comes home in tears. But there actually is a shorebird called a snipe that is sort of a marshy relative of the woodcock.
Uh-huh.
And they're just incredibly delicious birds. And, they sort of dart and juke and change directions very rapidly. So it's very challenging shooting and very delicious eating. And I think, you made a reference to the amount of information that was in the book. I mean, it's not like I had to do this all at once. I spent nearly a decade working for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. And as much fun as it was being publisher and editor of the magazine, I think my favorite part of that job was being able to go afield with the biologists, many of them with PhDs or masters in their specialties all over the state, and learn about what these state wildlife agencies do to protect not just game animals, but all species, non-game animals, amphibians, avians,
the fish populations, freshwater and saltwater, and how conscientious they are in setting bag limits and seasons in a way that the season, in a way that the species is always sustainable, and that a certain amount of hunting is not going to impact the survival of that species and its ability to thrive.
It's interesting. I'm guessing that most Americans who don't live in Texas or right next door in Louisiana actually forget that Texas is on the Gulf of Mexico, which is such an incredibly rich fishery, and they just don't even make the connection. And you obviously made that connection a long time ago, and it seems there are a lot of species of fish there that really don't thrive anywhere else.
Yes, and that's a very good point. And the other thing that I am so delighted to see is so many restaurant chefs embracing underutilized species that are maybe lesser known. And I think 5 or 10 years ago, they might have first used the expression trash fish, but now we've progressed past calling them trash fish and more correctly underutilized species that are really just as tasty but not as glamorous as the redfish, the speckled trout, the flounder are really the signature triad of the Texas and Louisiana, well, all the Gulf, Mississippi, Alabama, Florida, all five Gulf states. Nice. Those are the five signature fish. But you get into hogfish down in Key West, which are really gnarly looking. Sheep's head, which actually...
Oh, they're funny, aren't they?
Oh, aren't they funny looking fish?
Yeah, we saw them and where were we? Well, South Carolina.
We had sheep's head in Charleston, South Carolina. And
yes.
the chef Frank McMahon at a restaurant called Hank's Seafood was the one who introduced us to sheep's head and said they were really wonderful, and he was always delighted to get them. But there was this roguish character called Clamor Dave, who was also the source of sheep's head, and he would never tell anybody where he got them from.
But he was sitting at the bar the night we were in.
Yeah, Clamor Dave was sitting at the bar, but he still wasn't telling where the sheep's head came from.
But I bet you, here's the thing. Sheep's head, their little rows of teeth actually look like human teeth. It's really uncanny.
I know.
But what they do is they eat barnacles and that sort of thing. So they gnaw off barnacles on pilings and jetties and that sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
So
exactly. Yeah, that's what Frank told us.
Uh-huh. We could have followed Sheep's Head Dave and probably got pretty close to the source of his supply.
well, he was down around the pilings on the jetties in Charleston, South Carolina, which is in a slightly different piece of sea.
Oh, I know, but I mean that's whether it's on the Atlantic or in the Gulf.
But you would have known where to look, right?
Yes. Yes.
Now you have like tips on foraging, what to look for, when. And some of these are kind of, I mean, I would imagine you wouldn't find them many places, but where you are, like your, what is it, sala cornea?
Well,
or chicken feed.
And I'm glad that that's the one that you pointed out, because what I worked very diligently to do, because I want people to step outside their door and notice things around them. Sala cornea is probably the most abundant foraged item. I think it grows on every continent. It certainly grows on every coastline in North America. But it's called sea beans, sea asparagus, chicken's feet. Has a number of different sort of funny names. But I know in the farmer's market in San Francisco, it was selling for $16 a pound.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. And here, you know, I was out with a group at a fishing lodge, and they were trampling it underfoot, and I was fixing supper for everyone that night, and served the sala cornea, and I said, this is what you were walking on today. It tastes like asparagus, but it's a little bit saltier. And same reaction. No kidding, we didn't even know that was edible. But it's turning up more and more on restaurant menus. It lives just below the tide line.
I see.
And really on every coastline in North America, you can find salicornia. So it's just a matter of teaching people what to look for and where to find it. And it kind of opens up your eyes to the world around you, I think.
Now, this is a lot of foraging cookbooks, I guess, in my opinion. We get lots of them, by the way. They're either vegetarian or vegan, because that's a lot of what you find in the wild. Your book is distinctly carnivorous. What you haven't hunted down and shot and figured out how to cook, I'm really not sure. But I thought your recipe for burgoo, Kentucky burgoo, was just about the living end.
Burgoo is something that the Kentuckians from one side of the hill to the other fight about.
Well, you read the recipe, right?
No,
You read the story. The story goes that they start this big pot the day before one of the horse races. I think it must be the Kentucky Derby. Somebody starts a big pot. And then everybody who walks by has to put an animal in the pot. So if you have a squirrel, you can put in a squirrel. If you have a rabbit, you can put in a rabbit.
Oh, dear.
If you have some kind of bird, you can put that in. And they just keep on cooking it and cooking it and cooking it.
And the ladies bring the last of their canned goods that had made it over the winter before the summer, you know, because they pretty much say the shelf life's about a year. Canned tomatoes, lima beans, any kind of green beans, any kind of vegetables that were still around. But what I found out later through my mother about my papa and my Uncle Dorsey, you see, the men insisted that they had to stay up all night the night before to tend the fire and keep the fire going.
Sure, sure.
And because they had to add a little bit of bourbon to it every now and then.
Oh, yeah, right?
so they had a wonderful excuse, right?
Right, and then we found out later that the burger wasn't the only thing they were adding a bit of bourbon to.
It's really funny, Susan. We were talking with somebody who had a recipe for stew. It wasn't the barbecue guy. It was a rather elegant book, but it still had a recipe for Brunswick stew, and it said it didn't really reference squirrels very much, which apparently I thought were one of the main ingredients. So we asked them to find out how many squirrels went in the recipe. And she said, it's really funny. Somebody else asked that question, and I had a friend of mine who for some reason was an investment banker on Wall Street, I don't know why, but told this author that she could get her some squirrels, and she got 5. So that was how many went in the recipe.
Okay, well, there you have it. There you have it. That squirrels are another example of a extremely plentiful and delicious and underutilized resource.
We have black ones in the garden next door to our house.
I don't know if they taste different or not.
No, we don't know. We haven't tried to catch them, quite honestly.
I'm not sure that within city limits that they smile on such endeavors anyway. I remember seeing black squirrels when I worked at Organic Gardening and lived in Emmaus, Pennsylvania.
Okay, well, so maybe they are native to Pennsylvania, even though Emmaus is like 250 miles away.
Right.
I was touched by the fact that, one, you report an occasion when you had shot a wild turkey and then you cried.
Ah.
Explain that.
I think that was one of, I'll just back up a minute. I really had not had like a long-term goal of writing a cookbook, but I had so many people, including a number of very well-known chefs, compliment me on the way I handled wild game, and another friend, actually at a Kentucky Derby party, that pushed me into doing this cookbook, and I looked at all the wild game cookbooks out there, and I felt what was really missing was a woman's perspective, and a tender-hearted wife and mother. And I do have moments when I, sometimes it's just a tear and sometimes I sob, but in that instance that you're referring to, I'm sitting there holding that big old gobbler in my lap after I had just shot him, and I'm just sobbing my heart out. And my boyfriend at the time, who's now my husband, stood a ways back, and he came up after a bit and put his hand on my shoulder, and I said, Shannon, what's wrong with me that I still cry every time I shoot a turkey? And he said, Susan, there's nothing wrong with you. There's something wrong with the people who have forgotten how to cry. Uh-huh. And I knew in that moment that was the man I wanted to marry, because he saw things the same way that I do.
It sounds like you had a lot of sort of other things in common, like wanting to shoot geese and wanting to shoot snipe and a wide variety of different things as well.
You might be soft-hearted, but all these pictures throughout this book of you fishing and hunting, you look pretty fierce, Susan.
Well, I really don't think I am. My kids might disagree with you sometimes, but being a single mom, you had to lay the law down every now and then.
Uh-huh.
But no, I've always been a really outdoorsy person. I was the firstborn grandchild, and my papa really wanted a grandson, and he ended up with me, and that didn't slow him down one minute. He taught me how to ride and shoot and hunt and fish and go with him every place.
But now what about the cooking? I mean, we've been mentioning all the activities involved in this, but your recipes are not only excellent, but they're also very modern.
Thank you. First of all, thank you so much for saying that.
Well, I mean, where did you get the cooking component to this?
Well, beginning at my Mama Grace's knee, because they had a big dairy farm and had a number of day workers that would come in and help. And she was always, it'd be, huge breakfast at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning with homemade biscuits every morning.
Yeah.
And then milk all the dairy cows, and then up to the garden, and then maybe dinner, never lunch, but dinner, full dinner for 6 or 8 or 10 people.
Yeah, I had that growing up too with a dairy farm, yeah.
But what I tried to do, because that was Miss Grace's full-time job, and we don't have time for that these days. What I tried to do was to replicate those results using modern tools and techniques and technology. You know, Miss Grace used to stand over an iron cauldron outside, stirring the lard pot with a big stick when they'd be hog killing time, when they'd render fat into lard. Well, I found out you can throw the chunks of fat into the food processor, buzz it a few times, dump it into the crock pot, set it on low, walk away for 6 hours, and come back and strain it.
You jumped ahead of my question, which is, no, listen carefully, because there's a small percentage of the population who have the opportunity, I guess, to forage in the way you describe, just because of where they live. But did you have in mind how someone who doesn't have the ability to forage, who lives on a city street like we do, for example?
But I forage salad.
Yeah, but you don't forage, you don't shoot geese, and you don't shoot snipe, and you don't catch sea trout.
I could get squirrels.
So do the recipes take this into account? I mean, is someone going to be able to pick up one of your recipes for, well, not burgoo, but some kind of chicken or turkey preparation, and even though it doesn't have in it some of the ingredients that you foraged, they'll still be able to make it out of ingredients they can buy at Whole Foods Market or Giant Eagle or wherever?
I would think in a lot of cases that would be true. You know, for example, like on the pecan-encrusted quail, if you don't have pecans, these use English or black walnuts, or use toasted slivered almonds or some other kind of nut. It might even be good with peanuts. I haven't even tried that. But I think there's some places that there can be substitutions. We actually wrestled with this quite a bit in the development stages of the book. And both my editor at Rizzoli and I agreed that this is about how to use wild ingredients.
Right.
And not so much about how to take a recipe for wild ingredients and translate it to buying something at the grocery store.
Got it. I get the message. I understand.
Yeah.
So you deliberately oriented it the way that you did. And good luck to anyone who tries to adapt themselves to their modern kitchen and store-bought ingredients. I think that's fair enough. I think it's an enormous contribution. I mean,
oh, it is.
I mean, how long did you work on it? 10 years, you said?
You know, the short answer is my entire life, because I've drawn on a lifetime of experiences in doing this. The manuscript and the photography and producing that sort of thing made for a real busy time for the past 2 years. But that was on top of a full-time job and other responsibilities as well. So, but again, like I said, it's stuff that I do anyway. It's my choice of recreation is to be outdoors, whether it's in the woods, in the marsh, just my hands in the dirt, in the garden. So I'm doing these things anyway. It just gave me an opportunity to communicate that to a broader audience. And in the foraging, I really did specifically go to the USDA plant maps and try to pick forageables that were as prevalent as possible across the United States to make it as accessible to people as I could. Now, some, like, for example, prickly pear tunas are going to be more unique to the Southwest, although they do grow through the South somewhat. But a lot of the other things, whether it would be hickory, pecan, red bud, American beautyberry, salicornia, are things that are pretty easily found throughout the United States.
Well, there's one last thing I want to say before we go, and then I'm sure you have something you have to go shoot or dig up. I thought I was very entertained by the story of how you discovered that prickly pear is prickly.
Of course, I worked up to that.
I'm not going to say any more. Except,
that's probably good. Yes.
I'll just hint that Shannon did a hero's job in removing the little spikes from where they certainly weren't supposed to be.
Yes.
And I can report to you that Miss Anne, since the statute of limitations has expired, used to go from garden to garden. Where we lived in Australia, and she would steal the prickly pear leaves off the prickly pears growing in people's gardens, but she forgot about wearing gloves.
And that was a nightmare.
And she paid the price. The wages of sin, as they say, the wages of sin are prickly pears in your hands, or wherever else they might touch.
Yeah,
those little globins can stay with you for a very, very long time.
Yes,
and if you want to know the rest of the story, you'll have to buy the book.
Okay.
Susan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much. It's been a joy talking with both of you.
You too, Susan. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Our next guest is a bit more, let's say, laid back and subdued than first two guests.
Relatively speaking, he'd have to be subdued in comparison.
Yeah, but he's telling us all about what's essential to the South. That's greens everywhere, particularly the kind that they take to a lot.
Yeah, I bet our last guest knew something about that too.
I imagine, yeah. And he's part of that series we love called Savor the South.
So, get ready for 1,001 recipes
from Thomas
for collard greens and others.
Yeah.
Thomas Head.
Yes.
Okay, here you go, Thomas.
Regular On the Menu radio listeners know that I really am very fond of a book, cookbook series called Savor the South. I can hardly wait to get the next one anytime a new one comes out. This current one is sort of after my heart too, because I'm a big proponent of greens. And Thomas Head, the author, is going to tell us his take on, as part of the Southern palate, greens. First of all, how do you define greens, Thomas?
Well, in this book, I primarily deal with mustard greens, collard greens, and turnip greens, because they're the ones that are most popular in the South.
Right.
But I have I give a nod towards kale and a nod towards dandelion greens and a few others as well.
They're my favorite, dandelion greens.
Yeah. They're so hard to get here.
Yeah. I grow them in the backyard. Yeah, I mean, we have a ton of them in the backyard. That and the other weed is wild arugula.
Yeah. One of the bad things about living in the city is that I have no growing space and sort of have to depend on what I can find at the farmer's market or at the Whole Foods has them occasionally.
Uh-huh.
One of the things I loved about your book was the fact that you really pretty much ignore the concept of quantities.
Oh yeah.
And what you cook as greens is called a mess.
Yeah.
The interesting thing is that they in the southwest, in particular the southwest of England where my brother lives, they let the Brussels sprout plants go wild. So after the Brussels sprout season has been there across Christmas and so on, they let the plants go wild and they grow these greens. Huge greens, a little bit like curly collard greens. And they're called spring greens, and you get a mess of them for a dollar.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
My mother and grandmother always talked about cooking a mess of greens, and that meant enough to feed everybody. You know?
Yeah. Well, but of course, my background is a Sicilian, so you know we got a lot of bitter greens.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, and I love those. We always cook greens. We like collards a lot. In fact, we had an upscale version of them in Charleston, South Carolina, where instead of just vinegar, they used red wine vinegar, right?
Yeah, the collards came from Wadwana Island, which is apparently, which is apparently a very special place to go greens. And then Chef Ed created some kind of super duper high quality, high flavor, sort of like a salad dressing, except it was a dressing for the greens.
Yeah.
And they were really good.
I think one of the wonderful things about Southern cooking is the way that it's continued to evolve. There's the way my mother and grandmother cooked, but there's also a whole new generation of chefs that are doing wonderful things with traditional Southern foods. I have a couple of those recipes in my book from chefs.
Which ones would you point to? Point out which ones you're talking. We could talk
the collard green marmalade from a chef in Monroe, Louisiana, my hometown. And there's a pork roll on turnip greens from a chef in New Orleans, and another wonderful turnip green soup that I got from a chef in Frederick, Virginia.
Oh yeah, that was some Volt. That was some Volt, right? From Volt.
Right, exactly.
Did you have any surprises when you were researching this?
Well, I guess I had never really. I mentioned in the preface that during my years as a restaurant critic, I was delighted to learn that other cultures used and appreciated greens. But I guess I never realized the depth of that use of greens until I started working on the book. I mean, they're wonderful Indian and Pakistani recipes, which I wasn't familiar with.
Yeah, that was a real.
Southeast Asian recipes. They were real Italian recipes.
What?
The Far Eastern ones were a real surprise.
Dandelion recipe, the salad with anchovies.
Right.
That's basically the Sicilian version. I can't remember now. I'm looking for it. Did you have hard-boiled eggs in yours?
No, I didn't have. I don't think there are hard-boiled eggs in this version. We had in the South a wilted lettuce salad, which is a springtime treat with leaf lettuce before it bolts. And we always had hard-boiled eggs in that, and a vinaigrette made with bacon fat.
You got to have some bacon fat in there.
Exactly.
I'm just looking at this. You don't have the hard-boiled egg in this one, but you do have the pancetta, anchovy, and garlic. And then we throw in the hard-boiled egg, and you've got a Sicilian version of our spring tonic salad.
That sounds worth trying.
It's good.
Now, Jimmy Vallis would approve, right?
I think so. Yeah.
Tell me this: do you cook a lot?
I do. Interesting. When I was reviewing restaurants, people used to say, used to ask me, what if you had to eat one cuisine for the rest of your life? What would it be? And I always said, well, it would be the Southern cooking I grew up with. And I left the South to go to graduate school when I was 21, I guess, and have never really lived there again. But I started, remembering my mother and grandmother's cooking and trying to cook some of the things that they cooked. Now, I put together a family cookbook a few years ago, and I realized when I got it together that I had a cookbook that basically had nothing but dessert recipes.
Oh, no.
because they didn't need recipes for the things that they cooked day to day, and so they never wrote them down. So one of the reasons that this Greens project interested me was that I wanted to see what I could recover of the way they cooked greens and depended on greens for their for their nutrition, particularly in the colder months.
Yeah, well, I mean, you couldn't ask for something more nutritious as a staple, huh?
Yep. Oh, yeah.
Right. A question. Do you have little parties with all of you writers for the Savor of the South?
Well, we never have. It's a great idea, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
I want to be invited
if you do that now.
Okay. I think there have been some parties in Durham of where three or four of the authors got together and did a demonstration and a panel discussion. But I see a lot of these writers every year at the Southern Foodways Alliance conference in Oxford, Mississippi, and that's how I know most of them, and we talk about Southern food a lot there.
Yes, I guess so.
Who's the guy who just wrote the one about barbecue? I don't remember. He's a history professor, but he's...
Don't put me on the spot like that. Reed is his last name. Reed.
There you go. Reed, yeah.
You guys should definitely get together.
He's a great sense of humor.
I got to know him and his wife through the Southern Foodways Alliance.
Uh-huh.
Okay, well, he has a wonderful, wicked sense of humor.
Yeah. The intro to the barbecue book had me laughing out loud.
Oh, me too. I loved it.
I like the Brunswick stew made out of, everything comes out of cans.
Yeah.
that must have been what my first wife was doing. She was cooking Brunswick stew. she never made anything she didn't like that didn't come out of a can. Oh, dear. Now, I was a little bit surprised that isn't some of the greens cooking in the South, especially in the African American community, don't they use these wonderful mysterious things called chitterlings and things like that?
Well, they do. I must admit, I've never cooked chitterlings. I have eaten them.
I don't think I've even eaten them.
I'm not aware that they're ever cooked with greens, but I'm sure they're served with greens. because it's, you know, sort of that whole panoply of southern vegetables and that people eat with pork, all the parts of the pig. You know. I have made, say, head cheese and, again, things that my grandmother used to make, but never strayed to the insides.
Well, I understand. It's many people suggest that they would never eat anybody else's chitlings. They would only eat ones that were made in their house.
Right.
Well, I wish you luck on this book, Tabitha said. And what else do you have going on?
And may you bring home lots of green.
Well, I'm sort of between projects right now. I do a little writing about restaurants. I've been writing for an insurance magazine. Insurance brokers evidently do a lot of traveling and are always looking for good places to eat. But I'm mostly just cooking and eating at home these days.
Well, that sounds good. Nice break. Change of pace.
Well, Mike,
right.
I think Mike must be a happy man and a lucky man to have you there to cook.
We get along very well in the kitchen.
So you cook side by side?
We do, yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, thank you so much for your contribution to the Save of the South series. And listeners, if you see this book in the bookshop, don't hesitate to turn back the flyleaf, because you'll find out that the color is green. it's the greenest book cover I've ever seen in my whole life.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Well, thank you, Thomas. And,
okay.
And keep up the good work.
Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
Time flies when you're having fun. That's the wrap for another week's program. We'll hope to see you again. Same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.